nap last night, okay?
Right.
Just having a good old time. Having a soak, relaxing myself. And in comes David. And he proposes the weirdest conversation that followed for the next hour. And I thought, I need to have this conversation with you.
Perfect. So,
he came in and he said, you know when a nuclear bomb is dropped?
Right.
There's a certain radius where there's thermal radiation.
Right.
And that would mean that at a certain point in that radius, oven pizzas would be cooked to perfection.
Oh. What?
Yep. Now, he's not wrong. This is the problem. He's actually not wrong. Because we assume, right, so we're going to assume your oven pizzas are where they should be in your supermarket within what would have to be a Goldilocks zone within the thermal radiation. And given that, say you have three freezers or whatever, again, a thought experiment, there's no way of proving any of this is possible, but it should be. You've three freezers, whatever, and given that a freezer in and of itself is just, it's an insulated box.
Right.
So it doesn't matter to insulation whether it's hot or cold. That freezer will essentially turn into an oven because it's going to be short-circuited.
Fuck. Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to be like a pressure box then, sure.
Completely trap the heat. But because it is nuclear radiation and not like an oven, realistically the plastic around it and everything shouldn't melt. So then I was wondering, is that pizza technically steamed?
Yes.
I would say so. He's not so sure.
I mean, I don't know how he's not sure when, one, he proposed this ridiculous idea in the first place to be ruling out any possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest. Exactly.
There's no way of proving it. I mean, there's nobody going to be running in. If it's hot enough to cook a pizza, it's hot enough to cook a person. Which also then led me onto the thought that there is a certain radius within that where a person is not going to be, like, you know, charred like they normally would from a
nuclear
blast.
Smoky barbecued, for sure.
But they would also be cooked to perfection. And then we would have to assume that there would have to be a wider radius for humans than there would be for pizzas because they're larger and thus require more cook time.
So kind of, it'd be more like a spit roast. Well, not like a spit roast, but you know what I mean? Like, has to go on for like a bit longer. So kind of like a stew. Like a paper stew.
Yes, I would think so.
Or like when you're roasting a ham joint in the oven for like a couple of hours.
And then he was saying, obviously, it would depend on how humans are meant to be cooked, because we're not cannibals, so we don't know how human meat. But from what I know of cannibals, I don't believe we're anything like steak, so there's not a thing of medium rare or well done.
No, I think it's kind of like pork, I think it has to be.
Yeah, or like ham or chicken. It's like, you cook it until it's done, there's no in between.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's eaten like
medium rare chicken and getting fucking salmonella. Yeah.
Well, yeah, chicken either, but yeah. I'm like, how do you even prove that? And then you also have a very short amount of time where you can in fact eat that pizza if you're quick enough to get there, in the event of the fact that it's not too hot that you are going to get cooked when you're going in to get the pizza. And if the nuclear fallout, where things start to become irradiated, because the pizza's not going to be instantly irradiated just from the nuclear blast. The fallout is what's new, is what's toxic. It's apart from where the actual blast has happened itself, but in the surrounding radiuses, if there's no, say, wind or anything causing the fallout to spread, it wouldn't be irradiated. So technically, you could, in fact, absolutely eat that pizza and it would be cooked to perfection.
Right. I'm just going to say right now that this is very ludicrous. And I've never 100%. Used that word in my life, but it calls for this occasion. And to be honest, it's absolute fucking idiots like that. That in the event of like a nuclear disaster and future zombies, that guarantee this would have something got to do with it, right? They're like, oh, let's go see if we can have radiated fucking pizza. And then something tragic happens. There's a weird mutation, zombies. Then we're all fucked. Stop that line of thought right now. Don't be giving people ideas.
Your thoughts on the thought experiment is don't talk about it or we'll cause nuclear apocalypses.
Oh yeah, try, like, won't speak it into existence. If anybody wants to listen to it, that'd be like, okay, if this did happen, that would be a good idea. Because it wouldn't be a good idea.
And then, it would be a terrible idea.
A terrible idea. So I don't want anybody thinking like, yeah, let's give this a try.
I'm saying. We work under the assumption that he is 100% correct, because there, in the chances of possibility, he probably is somewhere along the line. There is a chance within the Goldilocks zone, like our fucking planet, that, yeah, you can get a pizza completely cooked to perfection by a nuclear blast. First of all of the people within that area are cooked So they can't go to find out. So you would have to be outside of the affected zone, both from the nuclear fallout, the radiation from the blast, and fucking thermal blast of it, where it would be too hot for humans to enter without being cooked. So you have to assume then that you wait for the area to cool down. Hope for the best that the nuclear cloud of fallout doesn't fucking poison the shit out of you and doesn't come towards the store where you were trying to find your perfect pizza, and that you get there while it's hot enough to still be enjoyable.
Well, man, if it's steamed, it's going to be sweaty. Who likes sweaty pizza?
See,
people enjoy cold pizza. So, like, don't, if you were to, like, kind of take your time to get there so you don't get infected, I suppose. If, like,
the fallout hasn't come yet.
Under the assumption. It's going to be sweaty, like, if it's in a plastic wrap. So, it'd be soggy.
I also think it would be soggy.
Leave the pizza. Well, as Mary Berry says, a soggy bottom, nobody wants it.
Nobody cares for a soggy bottom.
Nobody likes it.
Yeah, that's the weird conversation I had for over an hour last night.
I mean, like, when you're trying to peacefully have a bath and then comes in with that shite.
I'm just here shaving my legs and trying to understand the concept of a radiated pizza, assuming that it's not radiated. You know what? Fallout 5. You know the way all the Fallout fucking games are like, your son goes missing, your dad goes missing, whatever, and you have to go out and... No, I want to see Fallout 5, and it's just the shelter, and they're like, the Goldilocks pizza is out there.
Like, even as a side mission.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Bethesda, get on it, Fallout 5.
You're welcome to the... All you can do is then just, like, give us a brief mention, like, in how The Last of Us 2 mentioned last podcast on the left. Like, they had a Hail Me, Hail Dean, and they mentioned Magoostalations in it. The boys are absolutely delighted. I have something funny to tell you as well. Like, it's not funny. It's pure... Well, it's funny for me, stupid for my mother, and she's going to be so embarrassed. But as you know, I was passportless for a little bit because I was lazy and just didn't bother to get a new one. And obviously, I'm going to go see you now, so I had to get one sorted, right? So it came in the post the other day, right? And one of my friends is living in Dubai now. And I was just chatting to mum and I was like, oh, it'll be cool now because I'll finally get a stamp in my passport. And she's like, what do you mean? I was like, yeah, do you know, if you go anywhere that's outside of Europe, the continent, you get a stamp. So, like, if I was going to America, if I'm going to go to Dubai, Australia, whatever, you get a stamp. And she got very sad in herself for a second. She's like, oh, I've never been outside of Europe. I was like, no shit, man, none of us have. It's expensive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, well, I suppose I will now once England leave. And I looked at her, I was like, nah, they're leaving the Union, not the continent. It's not like they can just nope out and the country migrate somewhere like different. I was like, you're actually a fucking agent. I mean, I was in the pisses. And she was like, it's like, oh, shut up, you. I was like, that's literally one of the stupidest things you ever could have said.
Oh, I could just imagine. My
God.
The UK just getting, like, really fucking massive oars and just pushing.
Migrating down south.
Just baiting the country out, just like, we're just noping out here.
I can't get over it. I was like, oh my God.
Oh, Karen. Oh. I mean, look, we cannot slate Karen, Lizzie. She's one of our only listeners.
She'd be raging with me now, but you know what? I told her I was going to tell you.
Yeah, she should have expected it. Anything that happens in her life.
Anything that's out of turn or like something stupid that I said, by Christ, am I making it my personal mission to tell everybody?
Exactly. We were on a podcast now because this is what we do. We talk for a living. We need to have stories to back that shit up.
Exactly.
So David and his dumb thought experiment and Karen swimming the UK away from the continent of Europe. Oh, we're sorry, we love you both. Also on the topic of our listeners, of the very few that we have been promising to do this for weeks and we never did. I would like to give a shout out to our number one fan, Thomas. Thomas, I finally did it.
I was so confused. And then I, like, forgot that we were scheming about it last week. And we, like, may mention them. Yes, Thomas, our brilliant listener who plied us full of whiskey and vodka the one time that we visited. Gent.
Full of conversation.
And we got to see sheep.
It was wonderful. And we got to see sheep. And cats also.
And cats.
Because we got a shout out to Bronnie too, who was a wonderful human.
Who is also
adopts all of the cats.
An angel.
Thomas, Jen, you're number one. We know you are. Even Bronnie will tell you that. But you know Bronnie's a close second, so we got to give her a shout out too. So, for yeah, sure. Shout out to our listeners. But aside from that, welcome to another episode of Cesspool, where we talk shit before we actually get into what we're supposed to be doing for the day.
I mean, do we never not?
Oh no, it's an impossibility. But we've only rambled for 14 minutes this time.
Not 40, which is a shock.
We're getting better at keeping an eye on the clock. So I applaud us for that.
Do you know what we should do? All right. Just to like crack ourselves under pressure and see how much we struggle. At one point, have like the countdown clock. So like we'll set a time. And it doesn't matter whose story it's on. It's like once that hits it, da-da-da-da-dum. That's it. That is your time. You can shut the fuck up now.
Do we only get the 30 seconds or is it just if we start spiraling?
No, it's if we start spiraling.
I like that idea.
You're welcome.
I think we might get sued if we use the countdown clock though.
What about if we change it? But ever so slightly, so then that we know it's the countdown clock, but then we can't be sued for all the money we don't have.
We just, because we're like haunted bitches, we can put it in reverse so that it just sounds like a demonic version of.
Do you know what? It really be then. Jimmy Carr's laugh backwards.
I hate that. Let's do it. That just made me feel genuinely uneasy.
Like, you're welcome.
Shall we roll to see which one of us gets to bother people first?
We shall.
Right. Once again, below 10 is me. Above 10 is you.
Is that you?
And it is... Ooh, 17.
Why? Tell me why. Right? I always get... No. We're going to stop that right now. I always get a gut feeling when I know it's going to be me. So does that mean I'm slightly psychic? Confirm. Yes.
It may be. I do recall one episode though where you were like, it's me. I know it's going to be me. It's definitely me. And then it was not you.
Called myself out.
But alas, this time it is. So yes, we'll count you in as psychic abilities for this goal.
Delighted.
Let's dive in.
Okay, so this week we are back with good old-timey murders, and I could not have gone any more old-timey if I tried, because we're talking about 15th century old-timey. And just before I start, I got my sources this week from Judy Rhino on YouTube and darkhistories.com. So I'm going to do Peter Stump, the werewolf of Bedburg. So, So Peter Stump was a German serial killer that terrorized Bedburg during 1564 and 1589, and he would be accused of cannibalism, witchcraft, and obviously werewolfery is what they called it, which I think
werewolfery,
which is a fabulous word. Werewolfery.
I did not know there was a term for it.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't it just roll off the tongue like really?
It
really
does.
Nice? It does.
God, we have some delectable words and sentences lately.
I know. So, firstly, I would like to inform you as how Peter got his name. Right. So originally, he was called Peter Stub, but he was given the last name Stump because Peter had a disability and he was missing his left hand, leaving him with a stump. So we actually only know about Peter's story because a book from 1590, so like very, very, very old, detailing the accounts was sent to England and translated from High Dutch to English by a man named George Burrs, who claimed to have witnessed Peter's trial and execution. So
Dutch?
Yeah, High Dutch is what they would have spoken in Germany back in like 15-odd, is like what the language was called.
That's interesting. I just find it quite strange. I don't know enough to say that they didn't speak Dutch here, so we'll carry on.
Oh no, like, I'm not trying to say that the fucking did either. I'm just right.
Anyway, I'm not linguistics say is not what we're questioning here.
No,
sorry.
You're good. So it was then re-released in 1933 by Augustus Montague Summers. Very beautiful name.
And cousin?
No, they spelt it properly. Not the way your bastardised version is spelt. But anyway. Boring. And the book was called Werewolves in Lore and Legend. Now, only two copies remain of that like manuscript today. Both of them are in universities in England. And you can go visit them. But like that. It's not like you can go and have a read of it. You're only going to see the front of the book. And it's going to look quite shit.
Yeah. You can't just flip through a fucking
ancient, because obviously it's going to fucking fall to pieces. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it's not like the way people can go see the Book of Kells over here. But
yeah,
that has lovely pictures and everything like that. And it's not the same, is basically just what I'm trying to say. Like, this book would be boring
to
go
down
and
read
see
this shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very unimportant. Now, so a lot of the details were muddled up from translation. Had to have been, because you're fucking telling me Augustus Montague in 1933 in all his big boots and education could translate High Dutch as well from like 50 yeah. Highly much doubted. So what you'll even see from like certain dates, things aren't confirmed or names aren't fully confirmed, so a lot of that was lost to it.
Yeah, I would say so. And like, I know again it is a different language, but it's evolved from the same language. And in Germany now there's so many words and sayings and phrases that you can't translate back into English because they just don't make any sense.
Okay, fair enough, right.
So I'd imagine it's very much the same back then, that they would have words and phrases and stuff that they don't have an English counterpart. Yes. And that's why we've stolen half of them, like doppelganger and schadenfreude and stuff.
Yeah.
We don't have an equivalent.
No. Well, that makes sense,
I'd imagine that was a big problem.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So Peter was born in the village of Eprat. I think that's how we pronounce it. David, I'm sorry I butchered it. You told me how to do it and then I forgot. And it was near Bedburg. And it's somewhere between 1545 and 1550. So within that 5-year gap, that's when they think he was born. It's narrowed down a bit, but
it's not the worst. Not a lot.
And at the young age of 12, Peter became weirdly interested in the dark arts and would frequently practice black magic, necromancy, and sorcery. So, certified emo. And like, I know we are all about odd at 12, but I feel like necromancy.
Yeah, necromancy's really
a bit far. Like, Peter, calm down. Go outside and play with other children.
So was he just really a grave robber? Because you need a dead body to try and practice necromancy.
Yeah. I don't know.
Or did he just go to the graveyard and just like shout incantations and hope for the best?
I'd say that's what it is, to be like that spooky bitch. And then if someone's like, Peter, what are you doing? You don't understand me.
Oh, this is just Peter. He is the problem child of the village.
I can just imagine him with a black, like, fucking flicky fringe now as well.
Oh, 100%. But it's the long hair because it's like the 1500s. So he just kind of looks like, you know, that fucking gimp out of Sweeney Todd that he comes in on the boat
with.
Oh,
my God. Yes.
That's him. That's who he looks like. Facts.
We figured it out. So he continued down his said dark path. And at the age of 20, Peter apparently made a pact with the devil himself. Which is also a fucking theme that why does everybody try and sell their soul to the devil? It never works out. As time does tell.
I feel like if you know like two or three other people that did it and they're like, yeah, you know her, like, yeah, all of her bones crack and she died of a heart attack 3 years later.
Like, maybe it's not
maybe you
idea.
Shouldn't do it. Yeah.
Just a thought. So he said he sold his soul for a trade. And I have this fabulous, very long-winded quote that actually took up 2 pages on my book, but is only 2 sentences long. So take it that what you will. It's very, very, very fucking annoying trying to read it. But alas, you will find out what he sold his soul for.
We got slated for this in school. Don't use commas, use full stops, break up your sentences. Don't make us have to say it all in one breath.
It's going to be a long one. Right, so the devil who hath a ready ear to listen to the lewd motions of cursed men promised to give him whatsoever his heart desired during his mortal life. So whereupon his vile wretch neither desired riches nor promotion, nor was his fancy satisfied with any external or outward pleasure, but having a tyrannous heart and a most cruel bloody-minded requested that at his pleasure he might work his malice of men, women and children in the shape of some beast, whereby he might live without dread or danger of life, and unknown to be the executor of any bloody enterprise which he meant to commit. The devil who saw him a fit instrument to perform mischievous acts as a wicked fiend pleased the desire and wrong of destruction, gave unto him a griddle, which of being put around him, he was straight transformed into the likeness of a greedy devouring wolf, strong and mighty, with his teeth great and large, in which the night sparkled like the brands of fire, a mouth grey and wide, with the most sharp and cruel teeth, a huge body and mighty paws, and no sooner should he appear in his former shape, according to proportion of man, as if he had never been changed. So basically, devil, bad man Peter, magic wolfy Hulk belt, puts it on, tears the villagers asunder, takes off bad man Peter again. If that was too long-winded, that's exactly what happened.
Magic wolfy Hulk belt, though.
That's what it was.
Okay, so yeah, so he wanted to be a killer. So yeah. The devil granted him the power to be one.
Yeah, but he wanted to have something that would basically up his game.
Yeah, yeah, of course, because anyone can become a killer. Not everyone can become
be a good one.
Magic wolf Hulk.
Yes.
So, okay, interesting.
And that was very long-winded. I feel like I need to take a breath. Right, okay.
Yeah, so, that was a whole thing.
That was a struggle.
It was an ordeal.
It was. But, right, so, despite his disability, Peter was actually a very successful and wealthy farmer. So, do you know, like, back in the day, it would have been a lot of, like, physical labour. Now, I know farming is now, obviously, but you have a lot of heavy machinery and stuff now to help you. But
yeah,
back
you're
in the
not
day,
out tilling the land by hand. No. And, like, sowing the seeds every line and, you know, all that horrible...
crippling...
slow shit that they had
yeah,
to do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So... he made like a really good name for himself and he was well known in the town that he was from. And he would actually as well take his cousin, Catherine Trumpin, as his mistress after his wife died. Gets worse. So he
we
had...
love an incest story on Cesspool.
And it gets worse.
Incest pool, sorry.
Oh my God. How have we never thought of that before?
I don't know. Considering the amount of incest we have brought up, I very nearly did a suspected incest story for this episode, but I changed it last minute, as you know. So, Incest Pool is just,
this
oh
is
my
actually...
God, a side series. On brand.
Ideas.
We will continue, because anyway. I'm derailing you so bad, I'm very sorry.
It's okay. So he had three kids, two sons and a daughter called Sybil. Now, the two sons, they couldn't find a name for them. Yet again, either it was lost in translation or the poor kids were never fucking cared about to be mentioned. But Sybil was. But the only reason why she was mentioned by name is because she had an incestuous relationship with dear old daddy.
Oh, no!
Yep.
First he's cousin fucking, now he's daughter fucking. Oh, Jesus
yep.
Christ.
So he kind of deserves to be made fun of. Just bear that in mind. Yep. So yep. From the age of 20 to 45, Peter would wreak havoc over the village of Bedburg. So by day, he would mingle with the people in his community. You know, be very, very fucking neighbourly. But then by night, as in like a very spooky thing, he would turn on the charm and lure women into the fields alone at night. And sometimes he'd actually just watch and wait for them, like essentially stalking them and then rape and murder them. So
this is a fun
yeah,
story.
He would rape and murder them and gouge out their eyes so they couldn't see while they were being attacked. So he'd go for the eyes first.
He went for the eyes first.
Go for the eyes first.
Was this in wolf form or Peter form?
No, apparently all his murders were done in wolf form.
So he's off raping them with wolf dick.
Yeah.
I can't...
Is it bestiality then?
Little Red Rocket like.
Yeah. I don't want to do it. But that means, are we taking it as like a werewolf, just say like more like a dog, or then like a werewolf more like Remus from Harry Potter? Like what depiction of a werewolf are you thinking?
Is it like Twilight? Of Van Helsing.
Oh yeah, that either, yeah.
Because, you know, they're very much still man-shaped, but like...
No, they're not. From Van Helsing. They're a big,
yeah,
massive beast. The one
yeah,
with...
but they're like, they're on two legs. Like, they stand on two legs. They have like big muscles and like...
Oh, well,
you know,
then, yeah.
The form of them is still quite man-like, even
okay,
though they have the big
saying.
Dog's head and stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what I'm imagining, more so.
Because I was going to say, with Van Helsing, they're all full of fur. And
yeah, oh yeah, yeah, no, they're still fluffy. It's just the general, like, outline of them.
Yes, yes, no, I get what you're saying.
If that makes sense.
Oh, that's kind of a bit fucking sick, isn't it?
Yeah. That's, I just feel like it has to be if he's doing a bit of rape, and otherwise it's, like, straight bestiality, and I'm
not trying to.
Not that
it.
The rape is acceptable, but,
no,
like,
Jesus Christ, no, we're not saying
we're
that,
getting into
like,
Zeus turning into a swan to rape a woman. We're getting into that territory, and we don't want to be getting in with the Greeks.
No.
Like... they were a rapey bunch. Not the Greeks themselves. Sorry, the Greek gods. Sorry, want to specify that.
Yeah, I was kind of like, oh my God.
The Greek gods were a rapey bunch.
So yeah, he'd gouged out their eyes. Like I said, rape them, kill them. But he'd also tear their joints asunder. So he'd like essentially rip their arms and legs off and just kind of leave them like a nugget.
I would have assumed disembowelment. The limb removal is surprising to me.
Don't you worry.
Oh, we're getting there. Oh, okay.
You won't be disappointed.
Well, thank God. Here I was thinking I'd have to sit through this podcast with no disembowelment going on.
I would never do that to you. Never. So, if he was to run into, like, a young girl, or by running, I mean stalked, or a group of young girls, and one of them took his fancy. Like, if there's too many of them, he couldn't go in, obviously, all at one and try to get her.
Yeah, of course. So it's easier to get the one that strays from the herd.
Exactly. So he would do then a frenzied attack and try and separate them and then take the girl that he had
that
his
he
eye
wanted.
On. Yeah. And like that, he would do what I said before, rape, murder, and then he would take off the belt then almost immediately as to kind of like eliminate himself as a suspect for whatever reason. But I'm like, Peter, man, you're in around the body, just saying.
Yeah.
Belt or no belt, people are like, what are you doing here?
I'm not seeing the logic behind that, to be quite honest, but okay.
There was none, but he had an absolute neck on him then, because when he was in his person form or human form, a lot of quotes yet again from me, but he would go then to the grieving families and offer his sympathy, offer like to give them any money because he was such a wealthy farmer, like if they needed any like financial support as to help pay for like bits of the funeral. I obviously don't know what way funerals were back in Germany back in 15 what fucking ever, do you know what I mean? But I'm assuming funerals are always somewhat expensive, do you know what I mean? Like,
I would say so. I would imagine so.
Yeah, he would offer up his services.
How nice of you, Wayne Henley. Like, fucking hell.
That's exactly what I thought of. I was like, you make my fucking skin crawl, Peter, thanks. So within a few years, Peter would rape and murder 13 girls and 2 pregnant women, slashing open their throats and reportedly slicing open their wombs and devouring the fetuses.
I don't know. I don't have words. Just continue. I want to say something, but I'm just not going to because I can't.
And I promise you this would be funny.
You promised me laughter.
So after the string of attacks, girls and women would stop travelling alone when necessary and would either like arm themselves with small concealable knives or would have men kind of escort them to and from where they needed to go. So Peter had to subside his urges until he had the perfect opportunity to strike. So he actually confessed during his quiet spell, quote, that he would still crave the taste of blood. So he turned to killing and eating cattle and lambs raw in the fields. However, his thirst for human blood, far too strong. And he became transfixed on killing once more. But this time he actually stopped selecting his victims based on how sexually attracted he was to them and just wanted to kill for the sake of it. So he wasn't even necessarily going after girls now anymore. Anyone and anything he could get his hands on, he wanted to kill.
Okay, so it was more of a bloodlust thing took over now than just the sexual satisfaction that it was originally?
Yeah.
I guess?
And that anyone even included one of his own sons. So he lured his youngest son out into the woods to like study the trees, study like the flowers and stuff. And while the son was distracted, Peter formed into the wolf and crushed the child's skull open and feasted on the brains that was now exposed, describing it as the most savoury, dainty, delicious meat to ever staunch my greedy appetite.
Staunch.
Yeah. Delicious, dainty meat.
I mean,
that is your child's brain, Peter. What are you on? Quite literally. What are you on?
I am stressed, Lizzie.
You're very welcome. I plan to do that. So after the confirmed 16 murders, the original document just stopped counting at this point. Just mentioned that there was many more to come. Or that had followed. So there was actually one attack. So there was 2 lads walking in a field with 1 girl. And obviously he was lining up your young one because he still wanted to rape her. Like, I know he was killing anybody at this point, but he still wanted to feed whatever sick fucking sexual...
The rape was still there for him.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was just now, like, as before, if he saw a girl travelling with a man, he'd leave them. So now he was going after the 2 of them. But the rape element was still very much involved.
Okay.
So he was actually stalking them from behind a bush and called out one of the names of the guys that were in the field. Because he knew all of them, obviously, because sure, it was in the same village.
Yeah.
So obviously they're like, who the fuck is calling me? And went to look. And then when the first lad never came back, the second one went to see what was going on because they had waited on a couple of minutes and they're like, oh shit, he still hasn't come back. What the fuck? And Peter obviously had murdered the 2 of them at this point. And he started to kind of creep out of the bushes as the wolf. And obviously the young one had seen it. So she fled for her fucking life. But Peter gave chase and...
You're not going out running wolf man, are you?
No. And yet again, raped and murdered her. The town guards patrolling the area found the bodies a couple of days later, but like they found the bodies of the 2 men, sorry, should I say, but the girl's body was never found, only her clothes, her bloody clothes.
Oh.
Yeah. So like, did he eat her entirely or where the fuck did he put her?
I'd say it sounds like he fucking completely devoured her bones and all.
Yeah.
Well, fucking hell.
Mm-hmm. So after that 25-year long spin, which I'm very, very, very fucking confused as to how it lasted that long, because if you're in a small village, because that's what it was called, it was a village, not a city, how can so many people die?
Yeah.
And not never come of it? Like, I don't understand. So his reign of terror would come to an end. So while on his hunt, he stumbled upon a group of children, but there was no adults or kind of carers in sight, so he was like, this is my opportunity. Going to grab one. So he launched his attack, separating the kids. leaving the one young girl behind. So he had tried to tear her throat out with his teeth, but because the clothes kind of at the time, she had a high stiff collar on, so he actually couldn't get through it. So she obviously
well starched was that,
honestly, and thank God. But she let off an unmerciful scream, obviously terrified. So there was actually a group or a herd of cattle in the field, and they got such a fright due to her scream that they started charging. And they started charging in Peter's direction. So he didn't want to be crushed to death via cow hoof. So he dropped her, and he kind of like tried to take like a step back, like stumble back from her, and she ran. She got away, and she's his only known documented surviving victim.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so she was able to
go. Saved by cattle as well.
Saved by cattle. There you go.
What a story.
So she managed then to go into the town and be like, there was a wolf. The wolf is after trying to get me. So now they thought, oh, lads, 16 odd people have died. Maybe now it's a good time that we get all the hunting dogs together and try kill this thing. So after 25 years of brutal murders, disembowelments, late stage abortions, the villagers of Vedberg finally had enough. A small group of men were enlisted to hunt down the wolf with hunting dogs and quickly trap the beast, so it actually didn't even take that much effort. They had trapped him into a cave, and that was it. So, seeing...
It took him 25 years to get the idea to spend 10 minutes of trapping this motherfucker. Like,
yeah,
really now?
He had to have been paying some people off.
Must have been, surely.
Had to have been. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's surely. No way. So, seeing no out, Peter accepted his fate, and he surrendered. So he apparently removed the wolf belt, transforming back into the man in front of the hunter. So I'm right assuming, right, all of these lads were shocked. And you know, you definitely have two lads from the background being like, is that Peter with the one hand? And then the one anxious fuck, Peter, Stumpy, is that you? You just know that's what's happening. And then we'll be like,
definitely.
Shocked to fuck, what's going on? But they didn't even arrest him because they knew him so well. They peacefully escorted him out of the cave back into the village so he can be dealt with by the magistrate. It's like, you know, he just tried to eat a child. I know,
and
you're in
shock. So many people that people stopped keeping count.
I know, but like, I know you're probably in fright because he's just transformed apparently back into his gimpy self. But even at that, would that not scare you into trying
even
to
more.
Arrest him? Like, yeah. He's clearly given up at that point.
It's like, this, he's fucking magic, get him. We have lynched people for less.
I don't know.
See, do you know what the problem is, Lizzie? Mm. The problem is, this is in fucking Germany, and they love rules more than they love justice. That is the fact. They were like, oh, but if we arrest him now, then we don't get the joy of doing paperwork. So let's bring him to the magistrate, and we'll deal with him that way. Because God forbid we don't follow a singular rule, the entire country will fall apart.
Well, the magistrate... He wasn't as forgiving as the lads that escorted him from the cave. So Peter was strapped to a rack and tortured. And if anybody is not weirdly obsessed with medieval torture, as am I, a rack is basically where you tie your limbs to a board. So your ankles, wrists, and it's cranked and you're stretched out. Now, obviously, Peter only had one wrist, so I don't know what way that worked, to be honest. So I don't know if did they just leave that side? Or did they like do... I don't... Because how can you stretch? He had no wrist to lock it to. So I don't know.
It's not like you can just tighten it around the arm because it would come off. It would just slide forward. Like, the whole point of the wrist is so that the hand stops it from falling off.
Exactly.
Or sliding off. So, interesting.
They might have only stretched out the three.
But then aren't you just kind of leaning? More so, rather than being like, there's no way you can stretch just the one hand because you need the resistance of your own body.
I don't know. I do not know. Like, it might be the case of it, like, it was laid flat, and then when the wheel was cranked, it was just pulling. So he kind of had like one limp side. So just say like his left or his right hand side was being stretched to shit.
Either that, or they like employed a serf to just hold on to the other side where there was no wrist.
Yeah.
So that they could stretch him.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That it could have, yeah. We'll go with that.
We'll go with
We're
that.
We're never going to know.
No. And obviously it was excruciating pain. So he quickly and unsurprisingly confessed his entire life story. It's like he was reading a page out of his fucking diary. So he dealt his entire encounter with the devil, his ownership of the belt, along with the names of his victims. Now, when they went back to look for the wolfy belt, it had disappeared and seemingly went back down to the devil from which it came. All that kind of shite. So like, did it ever even exist, Peter? I don't think so. I think it's mental illness. But anyway.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say there was no devil belt that turned him into a wolf man.
there's something just saying that it's not right.
Like, I could be wrong. It's just like a sneaking suspicion. Just a
small, small suspicion. Small shadow of doubt. So on the 28th of October 1589, Peter Stump faced trial for the murders of countless men, women and children. And even the cattle got a mention during the trial. Who the fuck do you are? Killing my animals. So they got their justice.
Oh, the murdered cattle. I thought you meant like the stampeding cattle.
Well, I mean, you can't really have them all on a jury. Story. I mean, like, did you try to trample this man to death after he tried to murder a child? No. Yes. Like, I don't think that.
No, I thought it was more like a hero shout out, you know? Like, they got a Medal of Valor after all this was over.
I mean, who's to say they didn't? I mean, a lot of it was lost in translation, so we don't know.
Very true. We're just going to say that it happened. Because you tell me it didn't. Where's your proof?
Exactly.
Fuck you.
It happened. So he was found guilty and was sentenced to death to endure the torments of which his deeds deserved. And I felt like that was so beautifully said.
Oh.
So on the actual the night of Halloween, October 31st, Peter Stump was placed on a breaking wheel. Basically, yet again with a breaking wheel, it's kind of like a massive cartwheel and your limbs, yet again, I know Peter was missing one, had to like be tied to the spokes. And between those spokes, you were often bet with hammers so your bones would actually break through said spokes and they could torture you otherwise because you couldn't fucking move.
Ugh.
Yeah. So he was placed on the breaking wheel in front of an audience consisting of his peers and various princes of Germany. So like this was a big attraction that people were like dying to come down for and see. He would be burned with red hot knives, his skin ripped off with burning pincers and his arms and legs broken with mallets. And finally, after hours of torture, he was beheaded and the body burned. Now his cousin wife and daughter wife were accused of being accessories to the murder, so they were sentenced to death as well. They were executed by being pushed onto Peter's burning body and left turned to ash. So he was there burning like a pile of shite and they just like push. And I'm presuming poking them with sticks to keep them on the fire.
To keep them in there, yeah. Because obviously you're going to try and fucking run from the fire.
Yeah.
Like you're not just going to be like, oh, well, I guess I'll just lie down here on top of my cousin, husband, dad. And and just die. Like, yeah, this is fine.
This is fine.
That'll be fine. Like, no, you're going to scream. You're going to run. You're like, yeah, no. They probably bound them as well, I'd say. Like, hogtied them and fucked them on.
Oh, probably. I just find it's that. The most dramatic thing to do. Like, haha, you are not Very. Burning on the stake. You are burning on the body of your lover, father, cousin. Yeah. Werewolf, cannibal, most likely mentally ill.
Family Rapist.
Member. Yeah.
Abortionist. It's Obtrician. Optician. Fuck, I said it wrong.
I knew what you meant.
Yeah, it's fine.
So the magistrate were very, very proud of themselves. And to celebrate the fall of the wolf, they made a shrine. So they used the breaking wheel as a centrepiece with a lovely little cute engraving of a wolf placed on the top and along with Peter's decapitated head. And the whole thing was encircled Stunning. With 16 pieces of wood to symbolise his 16 known victims. And that remained actually in the town for a couple of years, apparently. Until, I suppose, Peter's fleshy head decided to rot away from maggots.
So we decided to.
Decided. He was like, oh, I think it's time.
Time to disintegrate, I guess.
Oh, I've had enough. So we kind of have to ask ourselves, was Peter possibly suffering from some sort of psychosis? Either be like, you know, what's the word that he used to have? Let me find it because I have it written down. Oh yeah, clinical lycanthropy is actually a thing. So it's where people genuinely believe that they're werewolves. Like that they were born as a wolf. Like that's a genuine condition. Yeah. And like, did
on every level except physical, I am a wolf.
So yeah, did he just legitimately think that he was a wolf and made a deal with the devil? Like, obviously he did do the killings, but it's like, in what way? Or would I think, was it just lost in translation? So, obviously, like, that could have been a serial killer, but the accounts were translated poorly. So the description of the wolf alluded to, like, the animalistic behaviour and the savagery of the attacks, as opposed to a literal wolf. So if they were describing him as this big, burly beast, like, do you know, like the fucking Undertaker from wrestling? Like, yeah, that's his name, but he's not working in a mortuary 4 days out of a week. So it's like, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's a name given the same way as the Green River Killer, shit like that. It's just kind of identified like that. If they're going to give him a name, they're not going to see this as like any normal human is going to be able to do this. So they've called him basically a beast.
Yeah, with the ripped off limbs and stuff.
Yeah.
And it could be very well that they assumed that it was some sort of creature that was doing the murders.
Given how savage, like their throats being ripped out and everything like that. Like, I'm not saying obviously he was able to bite through them as a human, but sure, like, he was a fireman. How many like fireman tools that he had? Do you know, like, what are they? The scythes?
Yeah, the little like half moon thing.
Yeah. Like,
yeah,
there's no way
a
that could...
Or a sickle? Is it a sickle or
no, I think there's a scythe and a sickle. I think they're two separate things. But like that, they both have a curved blade, but there's no saying that couldn't have looked like if they tried to describe it as like a claw mark from a wolf. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that would be easy to kind of pop a socket, an eyeball out of the socket with.
Of course it would. You'd hook that right out like a grape.
It's the limbs that are really disturbing me.
Yeah.
But like, strength? But then all that physical labour, he must have been fucking burly as shit.
Like, he would have been really strong, but just because they were off doesn't mean he didn't cut them off. Because we're assuming...
That's
like,
true. Yeah, this is the 1500s. It's not like they would have been able to be like, yes, this was cut, this was not torn.
Yeah,
you know, like, they wouldn't have been able to identify that.
Done by a metal object or anything like that. Like, they're not going to fucking know that, like.
No. That's true.
So... Yeah, and that is the story of the werewolf of Bedburg.
Well, you absolutely lied to me when you said that that was funny.
Well, I was laughing at it in my head. I think it's the way I had stuff written down, and obviously there's probably bits I like couldn't say, but...
It's like you only focused on the werewolf ridiculousness and forgot about all of the rape and murder, and dead children.
Yeah.
But I will say, there is a weird connection on a couple of levels between the story I picked and the story you picked this week. Again.
Why do we do this the whole time?
I don't know. I don't know how we manage to do this all the time.
Like, accidentally match, because I didn't even tell you what I was doing.
No. And, like, I only mentioned what I was doing long after you had your notes done, because I changed my topic, like I said, right at the last minute.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I think we're just magic. Will we just go with that?
Psychic, maybe.
Psychic, possible. Yes. Just really good at coordinating by sheer fucking accident.
Jedi mind powers.
Yes, that's the one. To get started on it, I will be doing the story of Pearl Brown. Now, apparently, this is a ridiculously famous fucking murder, and I had never heard a singular thing about it, but it is
still, heard a thing.
To this day, like, living in infamy. There's still books being published about it, songs being written about it, there's ballads about it, like, everything. Like, there's even a Ghost Adventures episode about it.
See, that I knew, but forgot about Pearly No-Neck.
Yeah. And I will get into that very, very lightly at the end, because it is a whole load of bollocks that I can't even explain in my whole entire life how much shite that it actually is, because they got all of the details wrong. And I'm about to give you what I can only say from my research are the true details of what happened, because there is the sheer volume of quotes and everything I have from my source that makes me think there's no way this isn't the accurate account of the murder.
Right. Okay.
So my source for this week has been "Please Tell Me Where's Her Head," Pearl Brown in Song and Story by Paul Slade.
I mean, excellent title, Paul.
Isn't it? This is exactly why I didn't tell you what my source was when we were talking about it earlier, because that is the best book title I've ever had in my Kindle library ever. So
please tell me where's her head.
So that gives a little bit of the story away, but we'll get into it. On the morning of Saturday, February 1st, 1896, a young farmhand finds a woman laying in the orchard of his master. Not an unusual sight for him, as he would often find drunk women passed out in the fields, usually prostitutes that had been entertaining the soldiers at Fort Thomas the previous night. As he went, oh yeah, they were banging basically. They were forever banging in this one particular field. As he went to wake the drunken woman, something told him that this wasn't the case. She wasn't just a usual drunk, because the position that she lay in, with her legs askew and her arms awkwardly above her head, along with the skirt of her pale green dress, would have been almost impossible for someone to sleep in, no matter how drunk you are. Our boy was no fool. Instead of going to wake her, he fucking ran. He went and informed the farm owner, John Locke. John was just like,
"Don't check on her."
No.
Like,
no, he knew something was up. He was like, no, fuck this. I'm going to go tell John.
Okay, well, look, I suppose I can understand that, like, getting a bit of a fright yeah. and not wanting to, like, see something that's going to mentally scare you.
That's exactly it. This was at, like, I think 6:30 in the morning or whatever. It was in the pale light. He couldn't quite see properly, but he just knew. He knew something wasn't right, and he was like, I better just go and tell John what's going on.
Right.
John then, in turn, tells him to go and get the local police in the nearby town of Newport, and then go get Colonel Cochran, who was the commander of the US Infantry Regiment at Fort Thomas. So, you know, where all the soldiers were banging the prostitutes.
Yeah, it was definitely one of them anyway. Just a thought, but anyway, go on.
No, I'm not going to say anything. Okay.
Okay.
Jewel Plumer, the county sheriff, and Bob Tingley.
Yeah.
Tingley Bob.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. His name gave me such giggles while I was writing this. The two of them, along with Locke himself, led a small party back to where the woman lay. So Bob Tingley was the coroner at the time. So that's why they brought him. So they were already like, yeah, there's something fucked up. Like, bring the coroner.
Yeah.
Tingley grabbed the woman's foot on the small hill where she lay and rolled her down it, landing her flat on her back in the road.
Tim, that's malpractice.
Honest to God, I was like, what part of that made you think it was a good idea?
And grabbing her by the foot and, like, quite literally, like,
yeeting her down a fucking hill.
Down a hill.
Yeah, it's like great handling here. I don't know if he thought maybe if she was, like, just passed out or whatever, that would wake her. I don't know.
But I feel like throwing her down a hill where she could have hit anything's attempted murder, but any
bit of malpractice on Bob's part, but sure, look. It gets worse, though, because that move caused the entire party that was there to scream in horror because the dress slipped away from her neck and revealed that she had no head.
Oh, wait, so the dress was actually covering the neck? Because I was like, obviously when the young lad went to see her, like, if you can't see a head, obviously she's not just drunk.
No,
she's,
yeah.
Very much dead.
So I guess when I had the way I have it written in my notes probably wasn't worded correctly, but her arms were awkwardly above her head, and so was, like, the skirt of her dress was pulled up.
Right.
So she was just kind of, like, bare arse in the field.
I thought you meant that when her skirt was up, it was kind of, like, just up at, like, maybe the waist.
No.
You know, as if, like, right, okay.
No, it was, like, flipped 180, basically, like, over her head, so they couldn't see, right. Well, over her lack of head. So they couldn't
where
see
her head should have been.
Yes, they could not see that she had no head. They only discovered it when Tingley fucking rolled her down the hill.
That's traumatising. A barreling body with no head is, like...
Honest to God, can you blame them for screaming in horror?
Rolling towards you. Oh.
So now, we have a quote from the Cincinnati Inquirer, which is the newspaper of the time, which is... Mm-hmm. Officers were at first inclined to believe that the woman had been outraged before she was murdered.
By outraged?
They mean raped.
Yeah, I'm thinking...
Which I find outraged is such a fun way of saying rape, because, like, I'm outraged by very small things, you know what I mean? That's what outraged means in this day and age, not
sexual assault.
Yeah.
Funnily enough. I love how, even, like, back in the day, like, they'd use any word but rape describe rape.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like... Why?
Anything but. They can't be using a dirty word like that for such a terrible act.
See, that is outrageous.
Thank you. I agree. But alas, the quote continues. The upper part of her dress was open, as was the garment beneath, and her bosom was bare. The skirt band was unloosened, and the skirt of the dress was gathered above the waist. Beneath the stump of the neck there was a large pool of blood. So we also have a stump in my story.
Oh, neck stump.
So, yeah, that's just the basic description of what the Cincinnati Inquirer had for the condition of this poor, poor woman as she was found.
Jesus Christ.
Also found at the scene were blood spatter of about 3 foot high, reaching the underside of the leaves of the surrounding bushes. The ground was torn, showing evidence of a struggle, and a cut of about 7 inches deep was found where a knife was plunged into the ground in an attempt to clean it. So once or twice it was just bum, bum, bum.
Stamped in, yeah, yep. See, yeah, dragged the blood off.
Confirmed by a pool of clotted blood found at the bottom of it. All evidence found at the scene pointed to it being the site of the murder. So there was so much blood and so much, like, you know, evidence of the struggle and everything that her body was not dumped.
And the attempt to clean the knife and everything, do you know what I mean? And you're not going to have blood spatter, like, that high up in the air on the leaves.
Exactly.
If it was just a place that the body was dumped, like, it's, yeah, not possible.
And remember the height of that, because I have to say, we'll get through it, but the level of police work for 1896, I am astonished. They did such a good fucking job. I am so impressed.
And weirdly, as time has gone on.
But yeah, exactly.
Standards have slipped.
It was like.
Drastically.
A complete and utter parallel to the police work that was done in Dean Coral. Very happy with it, is all I can say. So we've two things that are very not on brand for both my storytelling and the cesspool storytelling. And the fantastic police work is one of them, because normally it's a shit job.
It's always shite, yeah.
We'll get to the other one shortly. The body was ordered to be moved to White's Funeral Parlour in Newport. Plumer knew this case would be too much for him to handle alone. So he called in Cincinnati's Chief of Detectives, Larry Hazen, for help. "I'm the sheriff of this county, and I think I'm a good sheriff," he explained. "But I know I'm not a detective." How fabulous is that? He knew he wouldn't be able to solve it on his own. He needed a detective to call it in. So he was like, obviously, yes, I'm a good sheriff, but I'm no detective.
Oh my God, please tell me it's going to be like a Holmes and like Watson situation.
It is a bit, but not with these two.
Okay.
It, damn it, sort of, in a way, like, they don't go into the,
I could see the
proper
movie
investigation
in my head.
But like, but it's funny you should say that, because the way I found this case was I literally just went onto Google, typed in old timey murder and seen what came up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I found an article which was 10 murder cases that had a twist comparable to Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, ew, I don't like that, that just gave me chills.
Yep. So this is how I found this one and the one that I didn't end up doing but probably will do in another time. Just a little interesting thing for you there since you said that. So
psychic.
Hazen put two of his best men, John McDermott and Cal Krim, on the case. Everyone assumed the body would turn out to be one of the Midway's prostitutes where the two were stationed. So yeah, it made complete and utter sense for the case to be passed on to those two. Examining the crime scene again, Krim discovered a set of men's footprints leading across Alexandria Pike and up the hill to an abandoned cistern covered by a large stone, where Krim found a large handprint marked in blood. The cistern itself was empty, however, and the footprints continued up the hill to the edge of Covington Reservoir. Plumer's next call was to Robert Carruthers, a professor at Ohio Medical College. The coroner, Tingley, had fled almost immediately after discovering the headless body. So he came, he saw, he rolled her down the hill, and he noped out of there. He was like, "I'm going to practice politics. I am no longer a coroner." Bye.
That's terrifying as well to see. But he was like, "Shit, man. I've just basically kicked a headless body down into a group of townspeople.
Yep.
I'm getting the sack. I'm going to leave before I get got rid of."
Yep. It was far too much for him. So he noped out of there. So, yep, Plumer called Carruthers. Because he needed somebody to carry out the autopsy immediately that he could trust, and he knew he could trust Carruthers.
Mm.
So when Carruthers then arrived, there was already a crowd of hundreds of people gathered at the funeral parlour. Now this part just shows how truly disgusting humans have always been.
Oh, why am I not surprised?
It can never be a happy story, can it?
No.
Relic hunters had come in force.
Oh.
Yep. And had already destroyed the bush that the body was found under, taking blood spotted branches and leaves, stones, and even saturated clay. Literally anything that had blood on it.
You're not edgy. You're fucking weird.
Yeah.
Stop it.
There was a whole thing, like, if they found even one of her hairs on, like, the branches and stuff, that was really sought after. They were trying to find pieces of her clothing because some of her clothing had been cut and ripped and torn apart.
Yeah.
Like, anything like that. And they were killing each other to try and get this stuff.
What is wrong with people? Like, I know forensic science wasn't exactly, you know, a thing back in the day, but do you not think, just out of pure common sense,
maybe don't destroy
don't
the crime scene?
Things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that causes a problem later on.
Not surprised.
Shocking nobody. But alas, any evidence that Krim and McDermott failed to find, they would have to do without. Carruthers began the autopsy and determined from faint impressions on her fingers. Now again, this is fucking amazing to me for the time. Right? He determined from faint impressions on her fingers that until very recently she had worn many rings and that they, along with the head, had been removed to prevent the body from being identified.
Oh, wait, I wonder, could have had to be like some, I know like a lot of jewellery would be identifiable because it's not mass produced like it is now.
Yeah.
It would have been like handmade.
Mm-hmm.
So most pieces would be like original, but sure, she could have had anything with like a family or a family sigil on it. Do like a ring or anything like that on it that would be able to like identify her.
Exactly.
Mad.
So they took them off. And he also identified that she had very soft hands so that she wouldn't have been, you know, in any manual labor or anything like that to have rough hands.
Yeah.
So was most likely not a prostitute as well. And that she had marks in her fingers of a seamstress.
Right.
And that she had a small mole removed on the thumb.
Oh yeah, sure. It would have probably like impeded her if she was trying to work. So if she would have got that removed. Yeah.
Exactly. She would have had to have gotten it removed. So all of that, like just from her hands, he identified that. Again.
Clever, clever man.
Absolutely fantastic work here. I'm so impressed.
Hats off.
And here's the second most not on brand thing for me telling my stories. There was no sign that she had been raped. She was not outraged.
Okay, I suppose just from like the position of the dress, because that's what my first thought was.
Of course. And the fact that her chest was ripped open, well, the chest of her dress was ripped open and, you know, she was laid bare. But that's where the good news stopped.
Oh, the clap was very, very
Now I'm going to attempt to do a old-timey intelligent man voice for this. I don't know how that's going to work.
I mean, look, try.
I determined that the woman was young, probably 20 to 21 years old, that she had been alive at the time immediately before her head had been completely severed, and that she had been between 4.5 and 5 months pregnant.
Oh!
The stomach content also revealed a large quantity of cocaine.
Pearly? Jesus, not when you're a child. Calm down. I'm off for a bit of a party, but...
Oh, this...
You're coking it up when you're pregnant up, like...
This is where the controversy starts.
And I love how you slipped into Dumbledore instead of intelligent...
I mean...
Ohioan, Cincinnatian, like.
Well, see, this is the thing. I don't know where Carruthers originally comes from, and he's a well-educated man, so I feel like he wouldn't dare sully himself with such a southern accent.
So
Dumbledore. Was he not a well-educated man of high stature?
Well, you're not wrong.
He had good evidence to back up his conclusions, too, as the torn-up earth showed that she had been flat on the ground when her neck was severed, and if there was no heartbeat to propel the blood that high into the bushes around her, it never would have happened. No, it wouldn't have been on the other undersides of the leaves up to 3 feet if she didn't have a heartbeat.
Yeah, sure, you wouldn't need the blood continuously pumping and then him hacking at her for the blood to be able to, like, spurt off. Yeah.
Exactly that. So she had to have been alive when her head was cut off.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like, obviously it's not great being decapitated, you know, but you wouldn't hope it was after death.
Exactly. You'd at least like you to be completely dead and gone and unaware of the fact that your head's been fucking cut off.
Oh.
But alas, no.
And, you know, it would have been, like, it was a knife that he tried to do it with, so that shit, it's not like it was an axe and it was like three swings, you're done. This is probably going to be like sawing, chopping.
Yep. We actually have a description of it a little bit further on.
Ooh, I'm excited.
So as much as 6 pints of blood had been drained from her body into the ground around her.
Oh my gosh, we only have, 8?
Yeah, I think so.
That's a lot, like.
Yeah, it's at least like 70% of her blood was just drained out, gone.
Ugh.
So again, point in case that she was definitely alive. Because Carruthers knew that cutting the head off a dead body would not produce such a result.
No, sure, it all congealed in the body then as well after a while, like especially if she was left there after a night or overnight, should I say.
Exactly. So his examination showed that the killer had slashed at the girl's throat before getting her to the ground and then cut the neck from the back forward.
Oh!
Yeah, it's real brutal.
I don't know why that's more disgusting to me.
I don't either, but it is.
It actually is.
Because it's like you're not just kind of slashing or cutting away or like hacking into it like a fucking...
You're sawing it from behind.
Yeah. It's like you have to pull the knife upwards and I don't know.
And I think it's because he's trying to saw through the spine first.
Yeah.
And neck bone first.
Yeah.
From the door connects.
Now, I don't have it written down, but as far as I remember, it was from the 5th vertebrae that she was severed.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's pretty bad, like. I mean, the whole murder itself is terrible, but like, just this part is just so...
It's creeping me out and I don't know why. Like...
Alas, we shall move forward and get worse. Fresh cuts on her hands had shown that she had tried to fight off the attack. And I cannot remember if I mentioned this further down, but I'll say it now just in case I don't. The cuts were to the bone. So she did not lightly try to fight him off. She really fought. Yep.
Yeah.
It's she really fought for her life. So as soon as news leaked that the girl had been pregnant, interest in the case doubled. Carruthers decided he had better preserve the dead baby and called John Youngblut, who ran a drugstore, to see if he had a container suitable to keep a human fetus in.
Oh, I knew they were going to like nearly pickle it.
Yeah. Youngblood emptied a candy jar of peppermint sticks and handed it to a messenger that then brought it to Carothers immediately. Carothers put the fetus in the jar and added a preservative and then carried it back to Youngblood to show him.
Why does he need to see that?
Oh, yeah, this is the part that I said. It was so scandalous that I was literally screaming while I was reading the book.
Look at the baby jar jam.
Yeah, because... No. Customers began to notice as soon as word spread about the baby in the jar, in quotes. My. And everyone was coming for a look. So many people came that he had like kind of a soda stream sort of thing, like a carbonated drinks area of his pharmacy. And he sold out. Like his sales were off the fucking charts because everyone came to see the baby in the jar.
Sorry to burst your bubble, love. It's a murder victim, not a roadside attraction.
Honest to God.
But who's going to enjoy drinking a Coke or a Fanta? Obviously not the brands back at the time. Sipping out and be like, oh, there's the dead baby.
It's like, refreshing.
Fascinating. And not vomit after. Yeah,
but honestly, as morbid as we are, I just think they were so much more...
Victorian age people are just...
Right?
Strange.
And there's no part of this that isn't like creepy in the way that the case is handled. That's the most scandalous moment ever in this whole story is when they put the baby in the jar and put it up in a fucking pharmacy so that everyone could look at it.
Oh, ew.
Yeah, we shall just trudge forward because no. Arthur Carter's famous bloodhound team.
Wait. Arthur Carter.
Yep.
Stop that right now.
Arthur Carter.
That is atrocious.
I mean, if you're going to be famous, would you not have a fucking rhyming name?
Arthur Carter.
His parents must have hated him.
Like, gobshites like me that don't, like, enunciate properly. If I was to actually say how I'd say it properly, like Arthur Carter. Like, that just sounds disgusting.
Arthur Carter.
Like, that sounds vile.
Think I went to school with him. I need to stop. I've bust out too many fucking accents this episode. Accents, yeah.
We went from Jarman to Dumbledore to old-timey and now...
Some sort of old-timey news reporter.
Scummy Limerick.
Scummy Limerick.
Not even the nice Limerick accent.
As someone from Limerick, Liz, there's no nice Limerick accent.
Oh, stop it.
You find it and I will confirm. Find it. So Arthur Carter and his famous bloodhound team were off trying to track down the scent of the woman in order to find her head. But Crim and McDermott were following a foot trail of their own. One of the people that had come to gawk at the murder scene on Saturday afternoon was L.D. Pook. Which is the only way I can imagine that's how you pronounce that last name. It's P-O-O-C-K. Pook.
That's Pook.
Yep.
100%.
Who was the owner of a Newport shoe shop. He had noticed how unusually narrow the woman's shoes had been as she was being carried away and could tell that they were a relatively rare size. So he came forward to tell Crim and McDermott to track down the number stamped inside the shoe to where it was sold and they could find out who bought it.
Clever.
Right? How fascinating is this? I'm just like, ooh.
I love how in, like everybody involved thus far, apart from the coroner and apart from the people that were just stuffing babies in jars and then letting people look at it.
Yep.
Been very intelligent.
Yes.
Like, so smart. And I'm very surprised, like, given the time.
It's just fabulous police work.
Do you know what it is? It's the detective work that you could only wish you would be able to do.
Oh yes.
Do you know?
Oh yeah. This like, is the detectives we the dream of being.
All the small things. Yeah, exactly.
It's like Criminal Minds level of detail noticing. Like, just zoom in. Like, tiny shoes. Rare. Let's find out where they came from. Onwards. Fabulous.
It's so smart.
So this then proved to be the most useful tip that they had received, as many, many people were coming forward swearing that they knew the identity of the woman, giving a long list of useless leads that the police had no choice but to follow up on. Because they didn't fucking know. They didn't have anything else to go on. So anyone that was like, that's my daughter, Carol, I knew her, Jesus, she went missing there last week. That's anyone who came forward like that, they had to follow up on them.
Yeah.
And like, if anyone sort of matched the description of the body at all, they had to let them in to have a look at her. To be like, is that her? But it was mostly just people that were like trying to get a look like.
I was literally just about to say that you're going to have nosy, creepy people going in just to have a look to see what the body was like, crying like, oh my God, my cousin went missing. Yeah. It might be her.
And there was
I'm not being smart. Like, a lot of people had seen this woman barreling through the fucking air. And like, would have kind of seen like what colour dress she had on and stuff like that. So these people could have used that. Be like, oh, she was last seen wearing a green dress.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, oh, okay, come on. Have a look.
Yeah, that's it. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it was very public.
Stuff like that would have spread, like.
100%.
Yeah.
And there was only one lead that they kind of got close to thinking, oh, this may actually be the thing. Again, I didn't write it down because there's a lot to still get through and it's not that important to the story, but I'll just tell you now because it's kind of, I find it funny. I can't remember who came forward. I do believe it was the woman of the house, of a boarding house where another woman was staying. She had basically run off with this guy, but he was already married and he didn't bother to divorce the wife.
Because that would have been too hard and probably illegal at the time.
And they didn't know where she was. They weren't sure where the wife was. And then the wife had their marriage certificate kept within her corset of her dress so that he couldn't get it to destroy it to deny that they were ever married. So with the dress being ripped open, they were like, oh yeah, that would make so much sense. Like, he killed her to get the marriage certificate so that he could run off with the mistress. But it turned out they were all very much alive and he had just fled Cincinnati because the wife was on his tail and she was following him everywhere trying to catch the cunt.
You have to appreciate it.
Honestly.
You have to appreciate it.
Gotta appreciate the graft. But yeah, so it wasn't her. But I just thought that was hilarious. The Monday morning following this, Crim, McDermott and Plumer headed for Lewis and Hayes shoe store in Greencastle, which was the store identified as the vendor for that particular shoe. Two of the three pairs in the store had been sold in that size. One to the wife of a soldier, who turned out to be alive and well, and the second as part of a graduation outfit by Pearl Brown, who had been living on a farm with her parents on the outskirts of Greencastle. Pearl had bright blue eyes and blonde hair and was described as slender with a pretty face and flawless skin.
I was going to say, oh my God, you're describing me. But then when you said slender and good skin, I was like, nope.
Also, the next part is the least you. A jolly disposition. And she was a Sunday school and church worker and a social favourite in her home.
Oh, not me at all.
Wrong bitch. Her parents had read of the decapitated girl and had already begun to become concerned that it may have been Pearl.
Well, she hasn't been showing up at home. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
She had left on the 27th saying she was visiting a friend in Indianapolis and they had heard nothing from her since. So the trio headed to her parents' house and after arriving, they extracted the pieces of clothing and evidence they had found at the scene. And her mother identified each and every piece of it as her daughter's. When asked who their daughter may have visited in Cincinnati, the Bryans mentioned a man called Scott Jackson, but could think of no one else.
So more than likely the father of said child that she was prego lego with. Mm-hmm.
So Crim returned to Greencastle to send a telegram that they had conclusively identified the body as Pearl Bryan's, and upon seeing the telegram, the office manager A.W. Early told Crim that he thought that his friend Will Wood might be able to tell them something about Pearl's murder. Wood was a friend of the same Scott Jackson that the Bryans had mentioned. And now we have one of my absolute favourite fucking quotes from the whole thing. Wood, being a rather reckless disposition, would go into Indianapolis to see Jackson. And together they would have a big time in the city. Both being fond of ladies' company, they spent much of their time together in the company of women of loose moral character. And were in several unsavoury escapades, escaping notoriety under assumed names.
Oh, my God. Loose morals.
Loose morals and unsavoury escapades.
Looking for said loose morals also have them.
Exactly. Why are the women, again, I know it's been a thing for a long time, but why is it the women that are of loose morals, but all the men fucking them aren't?
No, they're one of the lads.
Yeah. Disgraceful. Disgraceful behaviour. We have a dead woman and you're slagging other women in the meantime.
Basically caught, yeah.
Disgraceful.
Don't.
So Woods was in fact Pearl's second cousin and had introduced her to Scott Jackson in the spring of 1895. No, no. Woods just
no,
knows
no, something. I got confused for a second. I was like, then I was like, oh wait, no, this is the friend.
Yeah. It's just the guy that he was like, he might know something. He introduced her to Scott Jackson in the spring of 1895. And Pearl had become instantly taken by him.
Aw, Pearl.
He had shown early a telegram that he received, this is Woods again, from Jackson at the end of 1985, stating that he had been too intimate with Pearl. And as a result, she was pregnant. Several more letters followed suggesting various drugs Pearl could take to terminate the pregnancy. But it was all to no avail. Obviously, Jackson is in Indianapolis, but Woods was here in sort of Cincinnati and the area where Pearl lived, because she was sort of outside of Cincinnati, but still, you know, nearby. Right. So Woods was able to be in contact with her, but Jackson wasn't because he had left. So he was sending all the letters to Woods to be like, give her this, get her to take it, kill the baby kind of thing. And none of it worked.
That's a bit grim.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
But even if he was to send her, like, any other sort of letter, like, don't you think he's going to, like, the fella, like, the cousin is going to be reading it? Even if it wasn't plans to murder the kid. I mean, they could have been chatting about Anne.
Oh, no, the cousin, he was writing to the cousin.
So he wasn't writing it to Pearl, but looked sending it on to the cousin to send it on to Pearl, because he obviously couldn't get it on.
Yeah, no, he was writing to...
He said he couldn't contact her.
Yeah, he was writing to the cousin. No, he could write to her as well, but he was writing to the cousin to get him to administer the medicine. Medicine or poisons or whatever.
Yeah.
The failed abortions in this case. So, like, Woods was in on the whole thing pretty much, but...
Why involve other people? Like...
I don't know. I don't know why he just didn't communicate with Pearl directly. It baffles me.
Do I? It's probably like in his weird mind could have like lost respect for the fact that she got pregnant. It's like when it in fact takes like two to tango.
Yeah.
Somehow blamed her.
He's just sickened at his own self that he knocked her up and he's like, right.
Yeah, like had no intentions of like marrying her or anything like that. So it's like,
no, he most certainly
this is a detriment to me.
Jackson then wrote to Wood stating that Pearl should be sent to Cincinnati. He could arrange to have an abortion performed on her. That was enough to give Krim what he needed to arrest Jackson under the suspicion of murder. By 4 a.m. the following morning, they reached Woods at his uncle's house where he had been staying and dragged him out of bed for questioning. He first claimed that he knew nothing about the relationship between Scott and Pearl, but soon changed his mind when he was told he could answer their questions or be arrested for murder himself. So he sang like a canary.
Yeah.
Naturally, telling them just who Scott Jackson was. As it turned out, Jackson had several other girlfriends on the go at the same time as Pearl.
Oh, the dog, of course he did.
Uh-huh. And was determined to rid himself of her and the baby. He had apparently arranged a room for Pearl in Cincinnati, and she had left the following Monday to get the train east, so that was the 27th, when her family thought she was going to Indianapolis. Jackson was then arrested and at first denied ever knowing Pearl at all or that she was in Cincinnati, and claimed that he had nothing to do with any of it. Like, not getting her to go to Cincinnati, not even knowing she was there.
Like, you're forgetting you're sending telegrams to people that quite literally just ratted you out, otherwise they would have been convicted of murder. And then the girl's parents, who don't know you at all, only know your name. Cop on.
So, yeah, they weren't buying that, naturally, and he was booked. And police found 2 scratches on his arm consistent with defensive wounds and blood on his undershirt that he had tried to wash away.
Scruff.
Yeah, well,
get rid.
I mean, you know, it's 18, whatever, like, they don't have an awful lot of clothes. He probably only had the one.
Yeah, well, fucking get rid and get a new one.
Very true. Very fucking true.
I'm very smart.
He tried to explain away the scratches as insect bites that he had scratched open himself, but no one was buying it.
Yeah, because a fucking praying mantis just decided to tear up your arm, like, very smart.
So, by now, the newspapers had gotten wind of Jackson's arrest, and naturally, people were outraged. There was talks of lynching him, and one shooting gallery even had a sign up in it saying, "Put a bullet in Scott Jackson's brain. Win a 5-cent cigar."
Love that.
Which I think is fucking hilarious. Yep, with an effigy of Jackson for customers to shoot at.
I love it even more. That is hilarious.
So you literally, like, if you could shoot him square in the middle of the head, you got a 5-cent cigar off of them.
That is hilarious.
So the police took the threat of lynching seriously, as did Jackson, as he asked the guard, Cullen, to sit by his cell for the night to protect him. However, he still couldn't sleep, and at around 2 a.m. he approached Cullen again and asked, "Hasn't Walling been arrested yet?" Alonzo Walling was Jackson's roommate, and police knew of him, but had no reason to suspect he was involved up until this point.
Yeah, why would you?
Yeah, so little fucking shit just threw him under the bus. Cullen approached his boss and told him what the prisoner had said. who in turn marched right around to the boarding house, and by 3:30 a.m. Walling was in custody too.
This, like, if I was Walling, right?
Oh, I'd be so salty.
Cincinnati, see you later. Like, I would have been gone. Just because your mum's your roommate doesn't mean he's not going to implicate you as well.
Honestly. As soon as he got arrested, I would have been outie. But, yeah, this arrest produced crucial witnesses to the case. The first being a bar owner called John Kugel, who came forward with a valise that Jackson had left in his bar for safekeeping on Monday night.
What the fuck is a valise?
A bag. Pretty much.
Oh.
Just like a carry bag. But he had been arrested long before he could return for it. Inside the bag was heavily stained with blood and also contained mud and leaves consistent with the murder scene. Kugel claimed that Jackson had dropped it off and returned for it multiple times between Saturday and Monday. And until Monday, it had seemed to contain something heavy and circular.
Oh, it was her fucking head.
Yeah, we're pretty sure it was. He had done the same thing at another saloon, and the keeper there had also confirmed it seemed to contain something that he thought at the time was a bowling ball.
Who's carrying around a bowling ball?
When confronted with the bag, investigators asked him, "Isn't that the valise in which you carried the head?" To which he replied, "I guess it is, but I did not carry it." Well, who did? Walling.
Then why were you the one to drop it off at the bar if you weren't the one to carry it? So by dropping it off, you're assuming that you would have had to carry it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, he was basically trying to put all of the blame of the murder on Alonso, and basically what he said happened was this is so fucking outlandish. He basically said that Woods had gotten Pearl pregnant, you know, his cousin, and that he was writing to Jackson, and Jackson was like, yeah, cool, like, bring her here, we'll get her an abortion, it's all G, man. Yeah, he tried to say that Walling had offered to perform the abortion himself.
Tell me where Walling got his qualification from.
Because he was a dental assistant. And that may sound ridiculous, but it wasn't actually uncommon for dentists to perform medical procedures at the time.
I mean, I know they're both gaping holes. Doesn't mean that they're the same.
I mean, that is true. And yeah, it's either way, it was just completely, like, ridiculous, and nobody was believing it. Like, no, dude. Plus, as we previously mentioned, the telegrams. If it was fucking Woods, why would Jackson have written to him and be like, I was too intimate with Pearl and got her pregnant?
Yeah, exactly.
You literally admitted it in letters, you fucking
idiot, like.
Dick.
No sense.
So yeah, up until this point, Alonso had been trying to protect Jackson, but as soon as he heard that his friend threw him under the bus, Alonso told the fullest and most credible account of the murder that they had heard yet.
Yeah. He was like, get fucked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was like, well, if he's singing, so am I.
Mm-hmm.
So in short, Scott had gotten Pearl pregnant and she arrived in Cincinnati on the Monday. Woods' testimony was that Jackson went and arranged for an abortion for her. But Walling said that Jackson had talked of just killing her instead.
As if that's easier.
Well, apparently it was. Jackson himself admitted to procuring cocaine just days before she arrived, which was found in her system by Carruthers during the autopsy. Pearl and Scott had been seen in a tavern together a few hours before her death, and Scott was also seen slipping something into her drink. Mud from the orchard had been found on Jackson's jacket and trousers, which he had tried to dispose of, but Walling had led the police to them. And various items belonging to Pearl had been found in the pockets of said jacket and in the apartment shared by Jackson and Walling.
So they found all her rings and everything, they must have.
I think so. Yeah, they didn't say what belongings, but like a little bit of clothing, a little bit, you know, stuff like that. The bag as well that we believe was used to carry the head was Pearl's.
That's just, why?
Yeah, isn't there something so disrespectful about using somebody's own bag to carry their fucking severed head in?
Yeah.
This guy's a real fucking piece of work,
shit,
honestly.
Yeah.
He just gets worse. Like, the whole way... Right, we're almost done. You'll see. The two were each trying to pin the murder on each other, but Jackson was the obvious suspect. Walling had, by his own confession, been an accessory to the murder. The second crucial witness came forward, filling in the final gaps of the story. Police knew that an elderly black man had been hired to drive a cab for the pair to the murder site, and a man named George Jackson finally came forward to provide that evidence. He was put through heavy questioning to assure he could stand as a viable witness, since he was a black man in the 1890s standing against a white man, and the truth was not going to be enough to protect him. They needed proof. Basically, what they did was they got him to redrive the route that they made him take that night, and they had basically held him at gunpoint and everything to force him to drive there.
Man.
And he said he could hear, like, Pearl whimpering in the background, and they had told him that they were doctors and that she was sick and they needed him to drive her wherever so that they could take care of her. But
if you're a doctor, why are you holding someone at gunpoint to bring somebody somewhere?
They didn't initially. It was when he realized something was up and he tried to flee that Walling apparently got out and held him at gunpoint while Jackson stayed in the wagon with Pearl.
Okay.
So he brought them there and whatever, and then he said that he heard like an ungodly scream, and obviously that was Pearl being murdered, and he just fucking legged it.
Yeah, sure.
And he just said nothing until he had to say something.
Like, who was to say that he didn't think, well, they know I've dropped them here, obviously, and they know that they were acting suspiciously, so like, obviously they're going to like, could come back and kill him.
Like, exactly.
Get rid of any like witnesses as you can, because... Yeah.
And he was terrified. I mean, like, he messed up the directions a little bit. He went too far and he was like, wait, no, I don't remember this. And he had to go back a little bit. And the crowd that was following him to kind of prove that, you know, he did take this route and it was all viable. They wanted to lynch him there and then for making a mistake. They were like, he doesn't know what the fuck he's on about. He's making it all up. And like, yeah, they were like, no. Give him a minute, like.
Well, obviously,
and
like,
thankfully they did.
Because even under duress, like, you're telling me you're going to remember everything perfectly.
There's no way.
And especially, I'm presuming it would have been at night time, like, if they're at a tavern and stuff at first. So, like, everything's going to be different as it is in the dark, as it is in the day.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And then, oh, no.
And even up until the trial, there was, like, an uproar that they had allowed a black man to stand against them.
Oh, fuck off.
Yeah, fucking... We're not going to get mad about a racial issue on this episode because we don't have time for it. I've already harped on far too long with this story. but yeah, I was really, really, really mad while I was reading all about George Jackson. But he was a wonderful man and he helped get them arraigned for murder, so...
Good man, thank God.
So by the end of February, the two were officially arraigned. Now, it was like the start of February, the murder happened. By the end, they were officially arraigned for the murder. And Jackson's trial was set to begin on March 7th, with Walling's set to begin immediately after, because they thought it was fairer if they were trialed separately rather than together.
Oh, right. Okay.
On May 14th, the jury quickly and conclusively decided that Jackson was guilty of first degree murder and sentenced to hang.
Yes.
He was returned to Newport Jail with Alonzo to await news of his execution date. But 2 days later, the other inmates of the tiny jail cell sawed through the hinges of the back door and escaped.
Oh my God.
But Walling and Jackson stayed put. They rather take their chances with the legal system than risk the lynch mobs that were waiting to get a hold of them.
Man, you're going to die anyway.
Yep. Well, I think they firmly believed that they would be like acquitted, because they really tried to appeal and everything, but it just did not work for them. But
their own narcissism was their fucking letdown in that situation, because if they would have just ran and not been so confident in themselves when there was such staggering proof against
them. Yeah, they probably could have gotten away, like. But yeah, no, they were so scared of the lynch mobs that they were like, no, fuck it. I'd literally rather be hung by the state than be lynched by the mob.
What?
So on June 19th, Alonzo was also sentenced to death for the murder, as Jackson had taken the stand and tried to implicate him even further in an attempt to save himself. Walling had never a chance with a friend like that.
Like, talk about roommate from hell.
Basically, long story short, Jackson came out, and I think it was the day they were meant to be hanged, and it was postponed to the following day because of this. He came out and he said, I have one thing to say, and that is Alonzo Walling is an innocent man. He refused to say any more about that because he was afraid he would implicate himself further, even though he was already
going to be hung to death. I know you've just, like, oh, fair enough. Look, Alonzo Sean got himself involved, right?
He did that to himself.
More life imprisonment than...
From what we can see. He wasn't at the murder at all. He wasn't involved. He didn't kill her.
You have to look at it from the perspective of he still made that driver bring them to that location where he knew she was going to be murdered. So, no, fuck him. I have no sympathies.
Yeah, he was definitely an accessory, but, like, he didn't need to be hung for what he did, I don't think.
Oh, I very much am of the opposite opinion now, to be honest.
So, it was finally March 20th they were to be hanged, the following year.
Oh,
so that's how long their appeals process went on.
Oh, well, yeah, I suppose you have to exhaust all of them before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had their three appeals and they got more and more outlandish. They tried to, like, say that they had brought her for the abortion and the abortion went wrong and the doctor had killed her and they tried to cover it up and that's why.
So you took her fucking head off.
Yeah, the doctor could not have killed her during the abortion because she was killed at the site, so we knew that was bullshit.
Yeah, but even at that, like, you would have saw some damage to her. Like, do you know what I
mean? Her nether regions, exactly.
When there wasn't any of the sort, so...
So yeah, it took almost a full year for them to exhaust their appeals, but they did, and it didn't work. And at 8:30 a.m., a crowd of 5,000 people gathered to watch them hang. So a man had asked, he had in fact paid to build the gallows that they were hung from.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an ulterior motive as to why he paid to build the gallows, but I'll say that right at the end. The trigger was pulled at 11:40 a.m. and the two men dropped and were still for a moment before they began to writhe and twitch horribly.
Ah, oh, that clever cunt didn't build them high enough so their neck didn't break. Yeah. They choked. Yeah.
Someone had miscalculated the drop needed to kill the two men, so instead of snapping their necks, the pair were slowly choking to death.
Yeah, that was no miscalculation. That was absolutely full-on deliberate.
Yeah, for the theatrics, of course. It took almost 20 minutes for the two to finally be pronounced dead.
Shame.
So Jackson's body was taken away and cremated,
mm-hmm,
because they figured that the trophy hunters would come and take his body.
Yeah.
Or at least pieces of his body. So they just cremated him immediately so that they couldn't do that. But Alonzo wasn't like involved enough or famous enough or, you know, wasn't the one who got her pregnant. He wasn't the one who killed her. So they didn't care. So they gave his body back to his parents. Plumer actually said he was heartbroken. He had to look away when Alonzo got killed because he firmly believed he was innocent and that he had only helped, like, get Pearl to Cincinnati and he was going with the abortion plan. And then he just kind of got roped into helping cover up the murder by Scott Jackson.
But then what about...
Because they believed that they took her head and incinerated it in the dentist's university because they had a big furnace for, like, because obviously they worked on cadavers and stuff there, because they did do some medical practices as well. So they had a furnace big enough and hot enough to burn bodies. So we think that's what happened to Pearl's head.
I would agree. That's right. But I don't feel bad that he died.
No, I'm in between about it. I don't know. It depends on how involved he was. Like, if he was only roped in, like, Jackson kind of threatened him and you're going to help me get rid of her body
but
and cover
the whole,
up the crime.
Holding the other fella at gunpoint for me. Like, you didn't have to do that.
Yes, see, that's the thing. That was in question of whether that was actually Alonzo or not.
Right.
Because it was dark and he was under stress and stuff, but he identified him as Alonzo. So it's a bit, you don't know. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And we'll never know. That's the thing. He died. So he could have died an innocent man, but we'll never know. But the thing with the gallows is the reason he wanted to build it, he disassembled it immediately after the hanging and he broke it down into tiny pieces to sell as...
Oh, you fucking snake.
Yeah, as mementos of the hanging and made a fucking fortune.
Of course he did.
So that is the gist of the story of poor, poor Pearl Brine. But the story still goes on today because...
Bobby Mackey.
Yeah, apparently... Bobby Mackie is haunted as shit by the ghost of not, I don't think it's Pearl herself, but actually Alonzo Walling and Scott Jackson.
Yeah, because there's meant to be, from what I just remember from it, like a portal to hell or like a demon portal is what they've described it as.
So Bobby Mackie's music world has been described as the gates of hell. And they said, now, this is the part where I was like, Ghost Adventures on their bullshit. Oh, they said that they had taken Pearl's head there and offered it up as a demonic sacrifice.
Oh, fuck off, Zach.
Yeah.
Like, not everything is that dramatic. Like, this case was dramatic enough. Okay.
Do you know what I mean? And fucking, apparently he got Scott Jackson's confession. He confessed, like, the ghost of Scott Jackson confessed to the murder of Pearl Brine.
You think, right? Scott Jackson, who was defiant until his last fucking breath, is going to tell asbestos-riddled Zach Baggins what he was after doing.
Can we just call him an asbestos sack from now on?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, honestly, if he didn't confess right when his neck was about to be snapped and save the life of his supposed best friend, he's not fucking
telling you
now, is he? He's not telling fucking anyone.
God.
Yeah, so to this day, little Pearly no neck and her head has never been found. I just think it's fucking awful for the family, like, that her, literally, they've no idea where her head ever went.
No.
And they never told. Just tell them. Like,
if you're not losing at and by
saying
it, because you're going where you're going, that's already been decided by the court. Like, do you know what I mean?
Oh, I never actually mentioned it in my notes. I'm so slow. Remember I said that the trophy hunters had destroyed the crime scene and that caused problems?
Yeah.
The dogs, the bloodhounds,
Yeah.
They couldn't fucking track the scent to try and find her head.
Because everyone had trampled through it.
They had trampled through it. They destroyed the scent trail. So we may have been able to find her head if they hadn't destroyed the scent trail.
That could have been anywhere. Like, I'd say a safest bet was that it was, like, incinerated.
I think it was incinerated.
But then why didn't they just bring her whole body? Like,
you would think that. But then I'd imagine because...
I know it would be hard.
They would have had to drive the wagon back into town. And if it was soaked with blood and stuff like that, like, they would have been... It would have been very obvious because that's also how they confirmed George Jackson's story was he said when he fled from the wagon, because, you know, you sit on the top of them.
Yeah, yeah.
There was like a wing mirror that he bumped off of, I guess, and he damaged it. He dented it. And then they were like, yep, this is the horse that I rented out to him that night. And he identified the horse because it pulled to the left in a certain way.
Right, okay.
And he was like, yeah, this is the horse that I drove with. And they were like, yeah, this is then the wagon that I rented with this horse. And look, there's the dent in the left side mirror. So like little tiny little fucking details is how they caught them. There's no way that Zach fucking
Ball bag Baggins.
Is the one that is going to fucking get a confession out of Scott Jackson. I'm sorry, it's just not happening. If you would like to hear some ballads or songs... about our dear poor Pearl, poor girl, Brian. Bobby Mackey himself does in fact have a version of Poor Pearl, Poor Girl, which is like a way earlier version of the song. They all started way back when the murder, like in the early 1900s, the ballad started about her. And thus they continue to this very day. And no royalties go to me, but I have in fact purchased Poor Pearl, Poor Girl. And I will be replacing our usual outro with some of that song because I think it's fucking delightful. It's
such a bop. Like, regardless of the story, this is actually such a tune.
It's such a tune. Like, it's so catchy. You're going to hate me. I'm very sorry because it will not leave your brain once you hear it. But yep, so stick with us till the end of the episode for a little bit of country soul.
Woo!
But yeah, so that was Pearl Brian. Please tell me, where is her head?
That was so good. Pleasantly surprised due to decent police work, shockingly.
Honestly.
And then just the small details from outsiders like the shoemaker to fucking just notice that as she was being carted away.
If he hadn't noticed that, the chances of her body actually being identified were so much slimmer. Like, they would never have found who did it or who the fuck she even was if it wasn't for the shoemaker.
Yeah.
And that's insane to me.
That was so good. No, I really enjoyed that one now. And the fact as well that has, like, it ties in with, like, something spook. We love a spook. We match.
And there is so much more detail that I left out. There is so many details to this case that I strongly recommend reading the book that I cited at the start of my story.
And
I strongly
recommend it. Case of, like, they were looking at other people for the crime and stuff? Like, is it stuff like that that's in it that you never included? Or is it just, like, the nitty-gritty details? More so.
The nitty-gritty details. Right. There's a lot of it. And it's worth knowing about. Like, it's not that it's just, oh, stupid little shit. Like, of course, there is, like, whole 3 pages at the start of the chapter that just goes on about the population and the problems that they had at the time and the problems that the soldiers from Fort Thomas were causing. Stuff like that. Not important to the story of me telling it, but still interesting.
Okay, fair enough.
Because you get such an in-depth background and it follows a perfect timeline. Because normally when I do these books to do my research, they don't follow a coherent timeline and I get very stressed. No, it was the easiest, most wonderful read that I've ever had. Some old-timey murder.
This is always a good topic, though. I feel like it really is. They do. They have a flair. They're always interesting. And, like, it's either top-notch, like, pure detective work or shrouded in a mystery. And it's like, it's always so good.
But alas, I think between our thought experiment at the start and our two fabulous stories this week, I think we have run out of time.
I think you are.
So, about to wrap this up. I can't think of anything else. So, always be a hypocrite.
Don't forget to tense your ankles.
That was a disaster. And
join our cult. My God. Poor girl lay dead upon the ground. Poor Pearl, poor girl, her head was never found. Scott Jackson had a pregnant girlfriend. Pearl Bryan was her name. He and Alonzo Walling met her at the train. That night a plot unfolded. Poor Pearl lost her life. Scott and Alonzo both hung for that crime. Poor Pearl, poor girl, lay dead upon the ground. Poor Pearl, poor girl, her head was never found.
They each blamed the other and swore they would come back. Now they hold a nightclub in Wilder by the railroad track. It's been more than a century since they took her life away, but the legend of Pearl Bryan is still talked about today. Poor Pearl, poor girl, lay dead upon the ground. Poor Pearl, poor girl, her head was never found. Poor Pearl, poor girl, lay dead upon the ground. Poor Pearl, poor girl, her head was never found.